This is Audible.
Oh My Audiobooks presents Total Exposure, Book 1 of Jordan's Game, written by J.A. Huss, performed by Elena Wolfe, Christian Fox, and Teddy Hamilton.
Prologue. Evangeline. I like winter because I can wear a scarf that covers my face. January is my favorite month. When the cold threatens to overtake most people, I go outside, covered up from head to toe, and live. Free from stares of strangers, secure in the notion that I am alone and unnoticed in the city of people who are way too consumed with getting back inside to be bothered about me. The one among many who needs to get back out. This feeling is called many things, but I have my own name for it. It's the blur of movement, a flock of starlings forming a mass of collaborative beauty in the sky, the rush of traffic on a freeway, headlights passing by like time, the swirl of stars overhead that remind you, every time you look up, that you don't matter. It's anonymity, or obscurity, the blur. I'm part of the blur, secluded in the isolation of being nobody. It's not just a fantasy of mine. This is the world I live in so completely that today is the first day I've left my penthouse apartment to venture outside in almost 6 weeks. This is my day, because it's January and I can cover up from head to toe and live the fantasy for real. For once. I hope tomorrow is just like today. People think Denver is nothing but snow. I wish it were true, but it's not. 300 days of sunshine every year. Yes, it snows, and yes, there are a few weeks' worth of days like this every winter. Days when the wind is strong, and the snow falls sideways, and covering every inch of skin is normal behavior. But it's not enough when such days are your only key to the outside world. I spend my summers locked inside with the AC set as low as it will go, wearing sweatpants, and fingerless gloves, and hoodies. If I can muster up the will to leave my sanctuary, I wear a hat, and sunglasses and long sleeves, though the blouse is usually billowy and thin because of the heat. Even then, it's too hot to be outside like that, so I don't walk in the park, or go to street festivals down below on the 16th Street Mall, or eat on one of the patios of the numerous trendy restaurants. I just watch the blur from above, wishing for winter. I have a large terrace that wraps around my corner apartment where I can be myself in the summer. So I do get out, just not out. Like now. I breathe in the frigid air, not even minding that the wind blows down my throat, doing its best to suffocate me even through my scarf. Maybe I want to be suffocated? Did the wind ever think of that? There is no one on the mall with me today, though it's noon on a weekday and the shops are open. We're not going to get enough snow to shut things down, just enough to keep the world frightened and hidden away. And it feels good that they're the ones hiding and I'm the one out. I walk briskly down the mall, past the art gallery, one of the few places I actually do like to visit, especially early in the morning when no one else has time and I have plenty. A coffee shop, a Mexican restaurant that won't open for a few more hours, and then Mott's is right there. The used book and vinyl store. I got a call last night from Dan, the owner and one of the few people I consider an acquaintance. He found the recording I've been searching for. Mei Ling Chow, age 13, live performance number 71, 1959 in British-controlled Hong Kong. I push through the doors and the heat overtakes me. People always overreact with the heat during a blizzard, which I hate because keeping a scarf wrapped around your face indoors with a furnace set on 75 is more suffocating to me than the wind blowing down my throat. "There she is," Dan says. He's bent down behind the counter, so I can't see him until he stands up holding a stack of used books that were probably donated overnight, and now he's got to sort through them. "I got your message," I say, breathless. But not because of the cold or the wind. "Are you sure this is it?" He looks at me from over the top of his wireframe glasses and sets his stack of books down on the glass countertop that protects all sorts of semi-valuable trinkets. "RCA Victor." I breathe out, a huge sigh of relief because, yes, that's all he needed to say. There are many copies of this particular recording of Mei Ling Chao, but the one produced by RCA Victor is the real deal. I need the real deal. That's the one, I say, my heart racing with excitement. Why are you so interested in this one? He asks. It's a loaded question. He knows nothing about me. Not my real name, not where I live, not even my email. He has one contact number for me, and it's a digital number that reroutes to my cell phone. I collect, I say. I told you that. Yeah, he says, looking me up and down. I haven't been here in a long time. Not since early fall when I purchased the very first recording of Anna Kiko Myers. It was raining that day. An unusually cold day that kept people inside. So I was bundled up in a plastic slicker, wearing an overly large hat that was dripping water on his decades-old industrial gray carpet. But it's a very unusual collection. First and last recordings of child violin prodigies. I've never met anyone who collected those. Well, maybe people are boring, I say, forcing a small laugh. I like to buck the trends. Dan stares at me for a few more seconds, considering my answer. Right, but you've bought every modern-day female violin prodigy I can get my hands on. That's what most collectors do, Dan. We buy them all. Except you haven't bought them all, have you, Angela? I'm well on my way. So let me guess who's next on your list. Evangeline Rolaine, I say, beating him to the obvious answer. I have her first, but if you can find the last recording of Ms. Rolaine, I'll gladly take it off your hands. He eyes me for a moment, which is more thoughtful consideration than I can handle, but I resist the urge to check my scarf or fidget my feet, so I wait for a few seconds and then say, Can I see the record? Dan does a shrug with his hands, like he gives up, and then holds up one finger and says, Be right back. I watch him make his way through the numerous shelves of books and stacks of vinyl records, but he doesn't look back, and I take that as a good sign. He doesn't know it's me. He might guess, but that's his business. I am not Evangeline Rolaine, because she doesn't exist anymore. I busy myself looking at trinkets in the glass case as I listen for his returning footsteps, and that's when my eyes rest upon a stack of cards near the old cash register. What are you afraid of? I say, reading the only sentence on the top card. I pick it up and study the calligraphy. It's bold and dark, rising up from the thick paper the way one might print up a fancy business card, but it's square, the size of a drink coaster you might find in a fancy bar. I turn it over in my head and read the back. Dr. Lucinda Chatwell, M.D., Ph.D., ABPN Board Certified. And then, in a very fancy script, in very tiny letters, it says, We will conquer your fear together. And a phone number. Here we go, Dan says, so close he startles me. I push the card into my pocket and calm my racing heart as he makes his way around the counter and places the plastic-covered album on the glass. Mei Ling Chao. Last live performance at age 13, 1959, Hong Kong. He smiles at me as he carefully removes the record from the cover and says, RCA Victor, as he presents it for my inspection. The picture of the dog with his ear to the phonograph makes me want to pee my pants with excitement. I actually laugh at that thought, which must surprise Dan because he says, I'll take that as a yes. Yes, I breathe. Wrap it up. And how much do I owe you? Dan adjusts his glasses and clears his throat.
$7,052.
Wow, I say. She's worth a lot.
She is. You still want it? He asks. I know I quoted you foreign change, but you have no idea what I had to do to get my hands on this.
How did you get it? I ask. I don't usually talk so much when I come in, but I've been searching for this recording for, hell, since I was 15. 12 years.
You're not going to believe this.
Dan whispers, leaning his elbows on the glass so he can get closer to me.
But a friend of a friend actually knows her.
Really? I breathe.
Yeah,
he nods, leaning in a little closer, like we're sharing a secret. There's no one in here, so it intrigues me enough to lean forward, getting as close to him as I've been to, well, anyone since I withdrew into my own world as a teenager.
She's broke, he says, living in a senior center somewhere in Oregon. She had this and a few others she was holding on to, but she sold it to him for $6,000.
He leans back up like the secret is over.
Which is why I had to charge you 7+.
Is she ill? I ask. I don't give 2 flying fucks about the price of the recording, but her health...
Dying, Dan says, doing his thing at the cash register. Cancer, I think.
Oh, I say, my excitement deflating. That's too bad.
Yeah, Dan says. How do you want to pay?
Right, I say, reaching into my pocket for my envelope of cash and placing it on the counter. I knew he was going to charge me more than he quoted. He always does. So I always come prepared because the thought of leaving here without it, then having to wait for another cold, snowy day to come back, not going to happen. I brought 11,000 with me. Gonna take me a second to count it all out.
No rush,
Dan says. So I count out $7,000+ and then push the bills toward him. Double check to make sure it's all there. My eyes drift over to the stack of cards next to the register. What are you afraid of? What are these? I ask. Dan ignores me for a second as he finishes his counting and then laughs.
Some guy came in here last summer and paid me $1,000 to keep a stack of those on the counter at all times. I have no clue. Never called the number, but he says he'll be back every now and then to check on them. And if they're there, he'll give me another grand. So I keep them up.
Do people take them? I ask, picking one up to pretend I haven't already read it.
Sure, lots of people. He's been in here a few times to restock. I've made like $3,000 off the guy already. So fuck it, right? Free money.
Yeah, I say, putting the card down and carefully rearranging the stack. Fuck it. Dan puts my purchase in a plastic drawstring bag that says Mott's Used Collectibles on it, and then slides it across the counter.
So, Evangeline Rolaine, then?
What?
Your next request, he says with a smirk. If anyone can find Evangeline, it's yours truly.
Sure, I say. Good luck with that. If you find it, please call me first. I grab my bag and turn to leave, acutely aware that I've been in here far too long and said way too much.
I'll do that, Angela,
Dan calls after me. But I'm already back out into the blissful whiteout, so his words are just an echo in my head. When I get back to my penthouse, I rip off my coat and scarf, burning up inside from a combination of too many layers and the desire to hear the famous last recording of Mei Ling. She was only 2 when her parents put her on stage for the first time. They did it for the same reasons most parents of child musical prodigies do it. Pride. That's always a factor. Some of them, and Mei Ling's parents were among those, also do it for fame and fortune, a way to lift an entire family out of poverty. That's why my parents did it. I was 4, not 2. But what's the difference between 4 and 2, really? I was way too young to understand anything other than I was doing something that came naturally, something that I understood, something that I loved. It wasn't until I was 10 that I started realizing how much I'd been used, and it took a few more years, 4 to be exact, before I, well, let it drive me crazy. When the money ran thin, about the time I was 13, we were staying with friends. They weren't really friends. They were just rich people who wanted me to play at their parties. By 15, I was too old to wow crowds with my youth, even at stupid rich people parties. 15-year-old violinists aren't special. They might not be typical at that skill level, but the oddity is long gone. The money went with the fame. My parents had bought houses and cars. They'd hired housekeepers and drivers. We had parties until the very last cent was spent. Huge parties with me at the center. That's when I'd really had enough. I'd been traveling my whole life, never had a real home, or real friends, or any of the things most teenagers take for granted. Even very poor kids had more of a life than I did. So I rebelled. And then the court battles began. I begged a judge for emancipation, presented my case as methodically as I could, and came out of it free, but utterly alone. I only had one thing left. One thing my parents didn't sell, one thing they didn't get to keep when I left. A rare violin gifted to me by an heiress after a concert when I was only 8 years old. I sold the Stradivarius for $19 million at auction when I was 16. I've been living off that violin for more than 11 years now. The money isn't gone, but there's not a lot left. I don't work. I don't perform. Can't perform, I remind myself. And that's not my fault. It's a sickness. A mental one, yes, but still a debilitating sickness that I have no control over. That's my story. I don't need to stick to it because it's true. This penthouse was my first purchase. Bought back during the housing crash. I practically stole it from its original owner for a mere $3 million. Still, that's a lot of money, especially when half of what I earned off the Stradivarius went to taxes and 10% went to the auction house. I can't really afford this Mei Ling recording, but why live if you can't have one extravagant pleasure to brighten your day? So fuck it, just like Dan said. Just fuck it. I flip the switch on my turntable, pick up the bag, and gently remove the album from its plastic cover. I stare at it for a moment, enchanted by the tiny grooves in the vinyl that hold music. It's a small miracle in my eyes. I place the record on the turntable and make it turn, hesitating before placing the needle onto the edge, holding my breath, hoping I don't accidentally scratch it, and then exhale, and there is music in my house, in my head, in my heart, in my body, in my fingers. I play the air the way I used to play my instrument, wondering if that joy I used to feel as a child will ever come back to me. Or if I'll die up here in this tower, alone, empty, sad, and lonely. What are you afraid of? The question pops into my mind unwanted. It's not a fair question. Not in my mind. I never asked for this fear. I never called to it the way some mad people do. I never courted it, loved it, held it close. I want more than anything to be the girl I was before they ruined me. But I can't. It's a sickness. It's a disease, not just in my head, but a part of me, of my brain. We will conquer your fear together. No, I don't think we will, Dr. Chatwell. Some people are born tall, some people are born short. Some people are born smart and some not. Some people are born with music in their fingers, and some people are born to perform that art in front of people and make millions of dollars. I'm just not one of those people. I can't even show my face in public. Not because of who I am. That's not really my problem. No one knows who I am anymore. No one cares. No. The reason I've locked myself away in this penthouse is because I cannot stand to be looked at. I cannot stand to be watched. I cannot stand attention. And isn't it ironic that my God-given talent, my only talent, is to play the violin? A talent that's quite useless if there's no one there to hear it. I don't even own a violin. Haven't even played since I sold the Stradivarius. So I play the air and wander back in time when it was all real, before that first performance, when the music didn't come with watchers. When the performance wasn't about the money. When I was a child. I wish I was still that child. I go back in time and stay there. I forget who I am, where I'm at, and why I'm even alive at all. I drift in the blur of my own mind. 10 hours later, I wake up naked in the middle of the living room, the record still turning, the needle stuck at the end, popping to static. My eyes burn from all the tears that Mei Ling sucked out of me. My body is sore from the sobbing, my heart empty and my head pounding. I crawl over to my coat, discarded yesterday when I got home, and I pull out that card. I stare at it for several minutes, wondering what it would be like to conquer my fear with Dr. Lucinda Chatwell. It's an elusive dream, but I find my phone in the other pocket anyway. I press the numbers on the card. and when the woman calling herself Dr. Chatwell answers, I say, I'm afraid of watchers.
Chapter 1. Jordan. 1 year later. Walking past Turning Point Club is still hard. I really miss that place. Like, really miss that place. I thought I was okay with letting it go when I said no to Brick's offer to take it off his hands and keep the whole thing going. But even though I'm a forward-thinking guy, and all the things that would come with owning an establishment like that are bad news, I really miss that place. I like what I'm doing now, which is, well, what to call my current line of business. It's so goddamn innovative, I'm not sure it has a label. I mean, legally, it has a name, Your Game. And just thinking about it makes me smile into the cold morning wind. But it's just a shell corporation, a way to receive and distribute money. But if I had to put a name on it, I'd call it a fantasy fulfillment service. Sounds about right. Which is why I don't understand Lucinda's call last night. Also why I'm walking past the defunct Turning Point and into Cella's tea room this very moment. The door jingles when I open it. Not an annoying jingle like you might hear at a gas station or a dry cleaner. I'd call this more of a tinkling. Those teeny tiny bells bohemian women sometimes wear as anklets. Something like that. So it's soft and charming. And maybe even a little bit sexy. You're late. Cella calls from a couch in front of the window. I take off my scarf and coat, drape it over a large overstuffed chair as I pass by, and unbutton my suit coat as I walk over and join her. There's no one else here, since it's Tuesday and she's closed on Tuesdays. You look lovely, I say, lightly kissing her hand before I sit down. She rolls her eyes, but she doesn't bother hiding the smile. I charm the pants off Cella. Not literally. Anymore. Which makes me smile. Why do you always keep me waiting? You know I'm obsessively punctual, and you're the one who wanted to see me. I know, I'm sorry. It's just, I got a call from Lucinda last night asking for a favor. Cella lifts up her eyebrows. It's a question mark. I know her well enough to decipher that expression, and she knows me well enough to let me continue without asking any more. So she just pours me some tea and pushes the tiny pitcher of milk my way. I add the milk, take a sip, and then lean back into the couch cushions, wondering how much I can legally tell her and still get good advice. Well, I'm asking for a friend, okay? She smiles as she sips from her own teacup. Okay. So, this friend, he's sort of known for making arrangements for people. What kind of arrangements? Cella asks. Unusual ones. I say, wishing I could say more. Tell her everything. Cella is a fantastic fucking listener. She's not really my type as far as women go, but I think I like her better than Smith, Quinn, and Brick combined. She doesn't judge me, for one. She's so calm, and nothing I say ever surprises her. Cella is like everyone's perfect best friend. She's also highly discreet. If I tell her something in confidence, as long as I'm not hurting people, she won't tell a soul, not even Smith. So, is the problem the arrangements that need to be made? Cella asks. Or something else? I think about this for a few seconds. Both, I finally decide. I mean, he doesn't usually make this kind of arrangement, if you get my drift.
I don't, Cella laughs. But I can take a guess, if you can't say.
My problem is, this friend usually does more of a fantasy type thing, and this new request is more of a medical type thing. Cella says. Maybe you should ask Brick. He's the doctor. He's not a doctor, I say. Fucking Brick and his useless medical degree. He's a fucking psychopath.
Not so much anymore,
Cella says, blowing on her tea. Stupid Brick. No, I don't want to ask Brick. I need your advice. You're good at it. Brick, I shake my head. He can't even make a good choice for himself, let alone give someone like me, I mean, my friend, good advice.
Jesus Christ, Jordan, I know it's you. Just tell me what you need. Do you want me to agree this is a good idea so you can feel better about it? Or back up your intuition and say don't do it so you won't feel guilty for turning someone away who needs help? Just tell me what you're looking for so I know how to proceed.
Love how she always gets to the point. I'm not sure. I mean, I can help this person. I have someone in mind who might even be perfect for it, but should I help this person? And should I use the person I have in mind? I sigh. That's the struggle I'm having. Well, Chella says, taking another sip of her tea. It's all legal? Of course, I say. I'm a fucking lawyer. I can't be breaking the law. Does it involve sex? No, I laugh. That's the problem. This is like a real condition or whatever. I mean, it's a weird one for sure, but this is all on the up and up, and someone we both know has prescribed a treatment and asked me to deliver it.
Someone we know, huh?
I nod my head.
Okay, she says, taking a deep breath. Okay, I say do it then. She knows what she's doing. We've both trusted her before, right?
Which is why I came to you. I mean, you know her a lot better than I do. Me fucking her on her 40th birthday while her husband watched doesn't exactly qualify as knowing her. But yeah, generally, I think she's got her shit together.
Chella goes quiet for a few seconds.
What? I ask. What did I say?
She huffs out a laugh. God, that night.
She closes her eyes, waits a few beats, then opens them again.
That night of her birthday? That was the first time I went to Turning Point. I was just thinking about how much has changed since then.
Fuck, I forgot about that. You were there. Shit, I say, running a hand through my hair as I picture Chella walking down the stairs, hanging on Smith Baldwin's arm, already in the game, even if she didn't know it yet. Lucinda, the woman we're both pretending not to talk about right now, wanted Smith as her choice that night. But he was otherwise occupied, so she picked me, the new guy at the club. And that decision right there changed everything in my life. A single moment has power like that.
You okay?
Chella asks when my silence fills the room. Yeah, sure. Just thinking, you know, how things can change so fast.
So who do you have in mind?
What?
You said you might have the perfect guy for the job, but that was also part of the problem. Who is it?
Oh, I sigh. I don't know if you remember him from when we were kids, but Ixion Veneer?
Rings my bell, but not sure why.
We were friends, remember? You've seen him a bunch of times, but it's been like 20 years or something. He doesn't come to Denver much.
Ixion. That kid you were always attached to at the hip in grade school?
Yeah, him.
You're still friends?
Well, sorta, maybe. But I give in and admit the truth. Not really, but I wish we were.
So why would he help you?
Normally I don't think he would, but he's been drifting for a while now, in and out of trouble for years. He needs a change, I think. This might be a good change. That's not really the reason. I mean, it is, it's all true, but there's more to it than that. Things I don't want to get into now.
If he's always in trouble, then why is he so perfect? She asks. I mean, what's he got that you think you need?
God, that's a loaded question. He has a very specific skill set, something this job requires and not many others would take the job. It's kind of fucking weird.
Chella laughs. Everything you do is weird, Jordan, so what the fuck is going on?
I swear to God, it's not sex. I laugh. It's weird because, well, the woman involved is weird, and her problem is weird, and of course, there's the whole privacy thing. She's sorta famous. Used to be, anyway. And I need someone who can keep a secret, not blab their fucking traps off to the media and shit, you know?
And Ixion, the drifting troublemaker, is your man?
She's still laughing. Believe it or not, yes, he is. I sigh again. He's kept a secret of mine for a long time now.
You,
she says, one eyebrow raised.
Have a secret?
I nod, swallow down that memory. Yeah, never said a word. I would have been, but I can't even say it. So instead I say, I would have been in a lot of trouble otherwise. It kind of saved my ass.
But he doesn't talk to you now?
Not much, no. Not ever is the more appropriate answer. But I wouldn't mind changing that.
And this is an excuse to bring him back into your life?
Not like that, Chella. I don't want to fuck the guy. I just...
We were friends, you know, and I wish we still were. Plus, there was this other person involved, and I miss her.
He's with her? This woman you miss?
No, I say, frustrated at trying to put all this shit into words. No, forget about her. I just want him.
Chella smiles and leans back into the couch cushions.
Well then, what else is there to discuss? The request is legitimate. You have the right man for the job, and you get to help someone and make up for past mistakes with an old friend. I say do it.
Relief rushes through me.
But you didn't need my advice, did you?
She pauses to see if I'll cop to what she's insinuating, but I don't, so she goes on.
You just wanted someone to agree with the decision you already made. Regardless of the potential fallout, you want to do this, don't you?
I nod. I do.
Mostly for Ixion, right?
I nod again. That's right.
Then why are you so nervous about it?
Why indeed? But I know why. Because moments can change your life.
And you think this might be one of them?
I don't know, Chella. I just want this, right? I want to make things right between us, but it could go the other way.
And then you lose what you've already lost.
I huff out a laugh. Yeah, I guess that's the bottom line. I lost a lot in that incident between Ix and me. And I don't want to make it worse.
Hmm, she says. Okay, I get it. But making decisions based on fear isn't normally part of your modus operandi, Jordan. And as someone who did make decisions based on fear before I took that leap of faith that night you fucked Lucinda on her birthday, I'd have to say, nothing lost is gained.
That's not how that saying goes, I chuckle.
I know, she says, shrugging. I made that up when I was a kid, overseas with my mom. If you lose something, like one of your favorite shoes, for instance, and you go looking for that shoe, but you don't find it, well, you already lost what you don't have. So if you lose again, you break even, Jordan. You don't lose it again. Failing twice at the same thing is free. Doesn't cost you anything.
I nod. And we talk a little after that as we drink our tea and eat scones. But I leave there disagreeing with her final thoughts on my dilemma. It's possible to lose the same thing twice, and the cost is definitely not free. I know. I've been there before. I lost more than Ixion when he took the fall for me 7 years ago. I lost the other person involved. Losing both of them might as well have been everything. So, getting half of them back, then losing him again, well, that sounds like a very good excuse to get drunk and never sober up, if you ask me. I take out my phone and press Lucinda's contact.
Please tell me your answer is yes, she says.
Do not leave me hanging here, Jordan. She needs help, and she needs it right now.
God, this chick must be a mess, I say back, not answering her question.
Jordan, she presses.
I'll do it, I say. But I gotta get this guy, and he's been out of contact for a while, so she's gonna have to wait.
How long?
A few weeks at least.
She has a concert in 6 weeks. She needs to be ready. She needs to...
I understand that, I say, cutting her off as I pinch the bridge of my nose, staving off a headache. But this isn't normal, okay? This is weird, and I need this guy. Plus, we gotta get it all set up. So she's gonna have to deal until it's done.
Lucinda sighs on the other end of the phone. Okay, I can wait. But this guy, he'll do it?
Yes. I say, not sure. Highly unlikely unless I go in with a plan. No, he's never gonna agree no matter what I do. Yes, I reiterate. He'll do it.
If I play it right, you don't beg Ixion Veneer for anything, let alone a favor. He does it or doesn't do it based on what kind of fucked up mood he's in when you ask for said favor. Nothing lost is gained, my ass. Ix can still take a lot away from me, and even though he hasn't done that yet, that doesn't mean he won't.
And I gotta ask myself the same question Chella did. What does he have that I think I need? So much.
Chapter 2 Ixion An overly loud buzzer snaps me out of the most peaceful sleep I've had in years. But the clanking of the jail cell door brings me back to reality. Real fast. Ixion Veneer, the sheriff calls, like there's anyone else in this fucking jail. That's some name you got there, and some lawyer as well. I sit up, rubbing my eyes, wishing I didn't get so drunk last night. Took him 2 days, but he did it. Make that 2 nights ago, since I've apparently been unconscious for a while. I stand up, wobble because I might still be a little drunk, and shoot the sheriff with my finger. He's the best. Don't I know it, cowboy? I owe him a favor, which is why you're getting out today. I don't know what makes you so special aside from that ridiculous name you've got, but he's managed to persuade me to erase the fact you took a baseball bat to Drake Metcalf's pickup. I guess you owe him now, too. Wait, I say, blinking the blur away and opening my eyes wider so I can, like, participate in what's happening and catch up with the conversation. Who are we talking about again? Who else? The sheriff says. Jordan Wells. Fuck. Fucker. Motherfucker. That piece of shit asshole has the nerve to bail me out of jail. Some balls right there. I don't owe him, I say, managing a few steps toward the open cell door. He owes me. And this unexpected favor isn't enough to change that. The sheriff just says, whatever you say. He's about as tall as me, about twice as old as me, and if I know Jordan, and I do, even though I haven't talked to the dude in a pretty long time now, this here sheriff is more like me than he'll ever admit. Anyone who owes Jordan a favor like this is not an upstanding citizen. Well, the sheriff says, he's outside, cowboy. You can pick up your gun on the way out. We go through the motions of unbooking me for crimes I have now never committed, and the sheriff hands me a plastic bag with my leather jacket, my gun, still loaded, my phone, which says I have like 91 missed messages, and my wallet. Have a nice day, son, he calls, as I shrug the jacket on and hit the door. Back at you, Gramps. Outside, it's a balmy 37 degrees with a wind chill that makes it feel more like 17. But this is northern Wyoming, and it's January, so I can't complain. Jordan Wells is sitting inside the only car in the parking lot, which is actually the sheriff's SUV, talking on the phone. He nods at me, then points to the passenger side, motioning me to get in. I spy a helicopter out in the nearby field, and the rotors begin to spin up for takeoff. Perfect. Because I just remembered I don't have my fucking car, and I don't live in this two-horse town. I live 30 miles north in a one-horse town. So the ride home is a nice perk that makes Jordan's visit a little more pleasant. I get in the truck, slam the door, and warm my already cold hands in the blast of heat coming from the dash. Yep, Jordan says into the phone. Got him. I'll be back in town tonight, so dinner and we'll discuss. He listens as the person on the other end talks, then says, mm-hmm. Right. Perfect. See you then. He looks down at the phone, sighs, and then trains that infamous stoic glare right on me. What? I ask. Why are you such a fuck-up? I shrug. It's my natural talent, I guess. And no one called your ass begging for help, so this is all you, man. Well, it cost me a favor I didn't want to cash in, asshole. I need this fucking sheriff to play, and now he doesn't have to, because you... He points his fucking finger at me. Decided to get drunk and destroy a man's brand new truck. You owe me, Ix. $75,000 plus a favor. Fuck that, I say, reaching into my jacket for my pack of smokes. I don't need you to save me. I can pay my own debts, thank you. Jordan eyes me. It's a look that hides so much. But I can read his mind. He's wondering, was that a jab at the past? Was it an innocent remark? What was it? He grabs the pack of smokes from my hand, opens the driver's side window, and tosses them out. You quit, he says. So remember that when you get to Denver. Fuck Denver, too, I say, running my fingers through my hair. I'm not going to Denver. I'll go back in that fucking jail and take my chances before I go back to Denver. Well, unfortunately, Ix, that's not an option. I need you in Denver for a job. Fucking job. What job? I'll tell you when you get there. He shuts the truck off, pockets the keys, and opens his door, letting in a blast of Arctic air. Call me when you get home, and I'll give you directions. What? I ask, but he's already slammed the door and is walking off toward his helicopter. I get out and jog to catch up. You're not leaving me here, dude. I don't have a fucking car. Jordan spins around, angrier than I've ever seen him. I'm sure you'll figure something out. Because I'm not doing shit for you until you pay me back. So get your act together, Ix. His bad boy attitude is way old. He spins on his heel, adjusts his coat, and walks to the waiting helicopter. I stand there, pissed off and still a little drunk, watching as it lifts up and disappears into the darkening sky. Asshole, I say, the sound of spinning rotors fading. When I turn back to the sheriff's station, I'm alone again. Just me and the wind and the cold. I shove my hands into my pockets and head for the road to hitch my way back home. Jordan Wells can fuck off. So here's the deal, I tell the girl on the phone as I run my fingers through my now wet hair. That shower felt good, like the best shower in my entire life. I'm currently sitting on my bed in my one-room house on the edge of Washakie 10, Wyoming, sucking on a smoke and doing my best to placate the angry woman on the other end of the phone because I don't have a clue what she's talking about. I'm fucking sorry, okay? I just need to come by your place and get my car and my keys, I add, because she's got those too. Fuck you, Ix. Just fuck you. I told you not to get involved. I sigh and pinch the space between my eyes and stop, because that's a Jordan gesture if ever there was one, and I haven't done that in years. Dude's back in my life for 5 minutes, and I'm already picking up his mannerisms. Look, I'm sorry about the other night and whatever happened. You're such a dick. I don't even remember what happened. This girl just called me up yelling like I ruined her life or something. But how much of a life can one man ruin in one night? And you'd think I'd have some sort of recollection of that, right? I didn't really have 91 missed messages. It was only 47, and most of those were from Jordan. Dude must have been looking for me about that job he's got lined up, and that's how he figured out I was in jail. The other 15 or so were from this girl. My caller ID says her name is Rachel. Sounds a little mean, if you ask me, and not in a hot way either. So I called her back, and she's been yelling at me for, I look at the clock on the side table next to my bed, 8.5 minutes. And the only reason I'm still talking to her is because one of those almost incoherent sentences in her long rant mentioned my car and the fact that she was going to throw my keys in the river. I just need the car, Rachel. I'm not Rachel, she snaps. That's my sister, you asshole. You broke my phone, remember? Oh, the caller ID. But I trail off. Because if the caller ID said Rachel, I've obviously been talking to her, right? Yeah, losing battle this one. Fuck it. Either give me your address so I can come get my car or leave it somewhere and text me the location or whatever, because... She hangs up. I consider how much I really need that car back and decide she can have it. I don't care. I got a bike sitting 6 feet in front of me. But yeah, it's going to be a hell of a cold ride to wherever I decide to go next. But you know what? I'm tired of this place anyway. Losing the car is a lucky break. Now I don't have to worry about the logistics of getting my bike out of this crap-ass town and into a new crap-ass town. My phone rings in my hand, and I have a moment of hope it's Rachel's sister coming to her senses about my car, and maybe I won't have to ride the bike in sub-freezing weather. No such luck. It's Jordan. What? I say, answering it. You're coming to Denver. He says, like it's a command, like I actually take commands. You think so? It's a good job, Ixion, and it'll give you direction for once. He's a lot calmer than he was yesterday. But that's Jordan for you. He's all act, you know. Everything's a game to him. If he's pissed, it's for a reason. If he's calm, also for a reason. There's not a true emotion in that heart of his. Not one. Just an act.
Fuck you,
I say, blowing out the smoke from my cig. Are you smoking? You better not show up smoking. Don't worry about that, I say. I'm not showing up at all. I don't need your charity, Jordan. I can pay my own bills. In fact, I'll cut you a check for the 75 grand and send it.
I don't need the money back, he says. I need you.
I barely contain a laugh.
Why?
I can't talk on the phone. I almost choke on my smoke.
You never fucking change, do you?
That's not why. Be at my office tomorrow at noon. Talk then. The line cuts, and I just stare at the dead screen for a few seconds.
Asshole.
I decide tomorrow is a long way off, and I'm not going to ride my damn bike to Denver anyway. So hardly matters. I suck down the rest of my smoke in darkness, put it out, and rip the towel off my waist and get in bed naked. Sleep is probably the only part of my day that makes sense anymore. It eludes me. Sleep, I mean. Because I'm thinking about Jordan all goddamn night. I haven't seen him in a very long time. Don't even know how many years. Maybe 7? 8? Somewhere around there. And that last night we were together runs through my head like a fucking movie on repeat. If I never talked to the guy again, I'd be fine. Shit, I hadn't even thought about him. Like, at all. Just moving on, right? Doing my thing. Being me. But him showing up like that? The cryptic nature of his motives and the fact that we've got this history together, well, it fucks with my head more than I'd like to admit. And that's why at 5 a.m., I push the bike out into the blowing cold, wearing almost every article of clothing I own, and get in the highway, heading south. It takes me 7 fucking hours to get to Denver. There's no snow or ice, and the sun is out for most of the ride, so that's a lucky break. But sun hardly matters when it's 23 degrees and you're on a bike going 80 on the fucking freeway. I go because I can't not go. The memories, the questions, the way it all ended. You know, there's some people who drift in and out of your life, and you like them and all, but you don't have a reason to look them up and talk, or go see them. And then there are some people you had a really hard time letting go, but eventually you do let go, and then one day, there they are again, and it's like no moments passed at all since the last time you spoke. Like they've always just been there, even though they weren't. They were. That's what kept me awake all night. I could have just stayed up in Wyoming doing my thing and being me, but it didn't take much self-reflection to come to the conclusion that I'm doing a whole lot of nothing. Not to mention being me isn't as much fun as it once was, if it ever was. Maybe I should be somebody else? By the time I walk into Jordan's swank office in downtown, I'm pissed off that I talked myself into doing this. Tired as fuck, and so cold I might never get warm again. What the fuck are you wearing? Jordan says, eyeing my leathers. Whatever goddamn biker wears, I snap. He's wearing a goddamn suit that looks like it costs as much as that car I left back at Rachel's sister's house. You rode your bike down here? Long story. I close my eyes to signal that I'm not in the mood to tell said story, and he takes the hint, because he knows me just as well as I know him. Why the hell am I here? He stares at me. Looks me up and down. A whole scenario flashes in my mind in the time it takes for him to reach down to pick something up off his desk, where he says, I found her, or she found me, or you want to go to dinner with us? Because we've got reservations at the Grant. And he means her and him, as in the whole thing about us that made us and us in the first place. But of course, he doesn't say anything like that. He says, here's the job. Waving a large yellow envelope, handing it to me. Everything's in there, just... He sighs and pinches the space between his eyes. Stupid fucking Jordan gesture. Like I'm the one on his last nerve, and not the other way around. Just do it, okay? And be super fucking discreet. This is all anonymous. You do not show your face. You do not make any sort of contact. It's strictly surveillance. Got it? I rip the envelope open and take a peek. two keys, two bound stacks of $100 bills, which should be $20,000, and some paperwork. Is it legal? I ask, taking out the stack of papers. It's a dossier. Female, mid-20s, dark hair and gray eyes. For one, Evangeline Rolane. Of course it's legal. Why does everybody always ask me that? I'm a goddamn lawyer. Everything I do is legal. Yeah, I laugh, reading the woman's short bio on the top page. You're a goddamn lawyer, all right. Why does this name sound familiar? Jordan eyes me, waiting to see if I'll take that first comment any further, and decides I won't. And he's right. Because after the morning I've had, I can't think of a single reason I need to rehash the past to. She was famous once upon a time. Child prodigy, I say slowly, reading her bio at the same time. Yeah, I remember this chick. She was all over the TV when she was a kid. Right. And then she wasn't. It's your job to watch her. That's it. Just watch her. Got it? Watch her do what? I ask, flipping through the pictures. Just everything. Nothing specific. Why am I watching her? Someone after her or something? You don't need to know why. You just need to take that money, buy the fucking equipment, go to that address, put up the fucking cameras, and then when she gets there, you watch her. Where's the home base? I ask, looking at the blueprint of the house, trying to wrap my head around why he's asking me to do this shit. In the basement. There's a lock on the door and a separate entrance that leads to a gate. You do not ride that fucking bike to this job, you got me? She'll hear you, and the whole fucking point of this is that she never hears you, okay? So I'm spying on her and she doesn't know it? My laugh is loud, because that's some creepy shit, dude. Jordan sucks in a breath of air. It's cautious, that inhale. It's long, too, and it's filled with all the things that we left unsaid between us after college. She knows, Jordan finally says, carefully, like he's picking his way through a minefield. Just fucking do what I tell you. You've got a week to get set up, and then a few weeks of surveillance, tops. Then I'll pay you. I don't need the money, asshole. You know that's not why I'm here. I hear the unasked question. He hears it too. Then why are you here? But he knows why. I'll pay you anyway, Jordan says, ignoring what wasn't said. And then his tone softens. You just need to slow down, man. I mean it. You can't live like this much longer. It's going to catch up with you. I don't have a car, I say, changing the subject back to business as I stuff the paperwork back into the envelope. Hence the fucking leathers and the winter ride. He looks at me. Not the way he has been or the way he used to, but something different. Why are you such a fuck-up? He finally says. But that's not the question he's asking. What he's really asking is, what happened to you? I shrug. Just natural talent, I guess. He goes to his desk drawer, finds a set of keys, and throws them to me. I catch them one-handed. Take mine. Leave your bike here. I'll ride it home and keep it for you. Home, huh? I ask, looking down at the handwriting on the front of the envelope. Where's home these days? Same place. I look up at him. Really? He nods, then shrugs. I like it there, what can I say? Yeah. I whisper. I used to like it there, too. His eyes lock with mine. I'm sorry, okay? I shrug. This car might make up for it, I say, tossing the keys of his BMW up and down in my palm. Don't crash my fucking car, he starts. Crash, I snort, cutting him off, playing down the moment where we said absolutely nothing and everything all at the same time. I don't know what I'm doing here, but the feelings in this room make me want to get the fuck out and stay the fuck put at the same time. I'm not going to crash shit. Where is it? Over in the 16th and Lawrence parking garage, level 1, space 16. Just click the alarm and you'll find it. I have a million things to say before I leave, and none of them sound right. So I say nothing. He sighs. Heavily. Look, man. I know, but I cut him off. Don't get weird on me, asshole. I'll do the job. I'll even take your stupid money. But then, you owe me again, got it? He puts his hands up, surrendering to my terms. Fine. I owe you. Again. We hold each other's gaze for longer than we should. It's a knowing gaze, filled with ugly things in a shared past, and regrets, and all the things we should have said and never did. I turn away first, heading for the door. And we won't say them now either. I'm gonna make sure of it. Hey, Ix! Jordan calls after me. What? I say, my hand on the door handle, staring down at it, refusing to look back, ready to get the fuck out of here. It's nice to see you again. Thanks for coming. I swallow, then nod. Yeah. No problem. After I grab the car, I head over to the electronics warehouse and buy the equipment, spending all of Jordan's money. The house I'm supposed to rig up is huge. Proper fucking mansion is what it is. Cheeseman Park Historic District, which is pretty swank. 7 bedrooms, 2 media rooms, 2 offices, 3 living rooms, 2 kitchens, a game room, a library, and a ballroom that is now a formal living area according to the blueprints. 10,000 square feet of space to cover. So much space I had to chip in an extra $5,000 to Jordan's 20 because I wanted the newest control panel and a $2,000 leather chair. If I gotta watch this chick for whatever weird fucked up reason, I'm gonna do it right. And I'm gonna be goddamn comfortable too. It only takes me a few days to rig everything up, so I kick it in the house to wait out the rest of the time before this Evangeline chick comes by, enjoying the media room. It's fucking sweet, with a 98-inch 4K ultra screen. And the game room, because it's got a mini arcade from the 80s in there. Pac-Man and Tetris, Frogger and Galaga. Reminds me of the nickel arcade Jordan and I used to hang out at when we'd ditch in middle school. God, how I used to love playing Galaga when we were kids. He's even got Dig Dug and Centipede. There's a house-wide intercom, so at first I figured I'd just leave that on all the time and I wouldn't have to wire the place for sound. But I tried it out and it sucks. Like, that thing is from the 70s or something. Back when house intercoms were the epitome of high-tech. This one's all crackly and staticky. Practically worthless unless you don't mind your voice sounding like someone using an AM radio that doesn't quite pick out the station you're listening to. So the microphones go up. The day before she's supposed to show up, I go through all the rooms, trying to guess which one she'll choose to sleep in. Usually, when I'm not drunk and high and in the mood to bash brand new trucks up with a baseball bat, I can predict things like this. I have a natural intuition, which is why I do what I do, I guess. But Evangeline Rolane is kind of a mystery to me. I've read up on her over the past few days, spent her whole childhood performing like a trained monkey, then poof, disappeared. Will she like the feminine bedroom? Does she like white mosquito netting hanging from the ceiling? Does she see herself as a princess? Because that room is kind of princessy. Something your 8-year-old baby sister would have. Or maybe she'll like the teen boy bedroom. I can't imagine she'd pick this one, because it's nothing but shades of red and gray with a bunch of framed sports memorabilia on the walls. But who knows? Maybe Evangeline is a sports fanatic. There's a nursery, too. But unless she's going to curl up in one of those gliding rocker chairs, she won't pick that one, because it only has a crib. Maybe she'll take the master? I would. It's got a California king bed that even accommodates my tall frame. I've slept in it 3 times already just to check it out. I'm thorough like that. Plus, that room is classy, not too personal, like the kids' rooms. Gaudy, like the guest rooms. They look like they were decorated to impress, well, you know, guests. Maybe she'll sleep in one of the offices. They both have couches. Or the media room. Does she like to fall asleep in front of a TV? Hell, you could even sleep on the kitchen island. It's so big. If, that is, you don't mind a 10-foot-long slab of soapstone as your bed. I decided to make a little bet with myself just to prove I still got game. That I haven't been fucking off